Chapter 145. Preparing for the journey, during the remainder of the day we loitered about, talking over our plans. The doctor was all eagerness to visit Tamai, a solitary inland village, standing upon the banks of a considerable lake of the same name, and embosomed among groves. From Afretitu you went to this place by a lonely pathway leading through the wildest scenery in the world. Much, too, we had heard concerning the lake itself, which abounded in such delicious fish that, in former times, angling parties occasionally came over to it from Papeete. Upon its banks, moreover, grew the finest fruit of the islands, and in their greatest perfection. The E, or Brazilian plum, here attained the size of an orange, and the gorgeous Rhea, or red apple of Tahiti, blushed with deeper dyes than in any of the seaward valleys. Beside all this, in Tamai dwelt the most beautiful and unsophisticated women in the entire society group. In short, the village was so remote from the coast, and had been so much less affected by recent changes than other places that, in most things, Tahitian life was here seen as formerly existing in the days of young Otu, the boy king, in Cook's time. After obtaining from the planters all the information which was needed, we decided upon penetrating to the village, and after a temporary sojourn there, to strike the beach again, and journey round to Talu, a harbor on the opposite side of the island. We at once put ourselves in traveling trim. Just previous to leaving Tahiti, having found my wardrobe reduced to two suits, frock and trousers, both much the worse for wear, I had quilted them together for mutual preservation after a fashion peculiar to sailors, engrafting a red frock upon a blue one, and producing thereby a choice variety in the way of clothing. This was the extent of my wardrobe. Nor was the doctor by any means better off. His improvidence had at last driven him to don the nautical garb. But by this time his frock, a light cotton one, had almost given out, and he had nothing to replace it. Shorty very generously offered him one which was a little less ragged, but the arms were proudly refused, Long Ghost preferring to assume the ancient costume of Tahiti the Rura. This garment, once worn as a festival dress, is now seldom met with, but Captain Bob had often shown us one which he kept as an heirloom. It was a cloak, or mantle, of yellow tappa, precisely similar to the poncho worn by the South American Spaniards. The head being slipped through a slit in the middle, the robe hangs about the person in ample drapery. Tono I obtained sufficient coarse brown tappa to make a short mantle of this description, and in 5 minutes the doctor was equipped. Zeke, eyeing his toga critically, reminded its proprietor that there were many streams to ford, and precipices to scale, between Martyr and Tamai, and if he traveled in petticoats, he had better hold them up. Besides other deficiencies, we were utterly shoeless. In the free and easy Pacific, sailors seldom wear shoes. Mine had been tossed overboard the day we met the trades, and except in one or two tramps ashore, I had never worn any since. In Martyr, they would have been desirable, but none were to be had. For the expedition we meditated, however, they were indispensable. Zeke, being the owner of a pair of huge, dilapidated boots, hanging from a rafter like saddlebags, the doctor succeeded in exchanging for them a case knife, the last valuable article in his possession. For myself, I made sandals from a bullock's hide, such as are worn by the Indians in California. They are made in a minute, the sole, rudely fashioned to the foot, being confined across the instep by three straps of leather. Our headgear deserves a passing word. My comrade's was a brave old Panama hat, made of grass, almost as fine as threads of silk, and so elastic that, upon rolling it up, it sprang into perfect shape again. Set off by the jaunty slouch of this Spanish sombrero, Dr. Long Ghost, in this and his aura, looked like a mendicant grandee. Nor was my own appearance in an eastern turban less distinguished. The way I came to wear it was this. My hat having been knocked overboard a few days before reaching Papeete, I was obliged to mount an abominable wad of party-colored worsted, what sailors call a Scotch cap. Everyone knows the elasticity of knit wool, and this Caledonian headdress crowned my temples so effectually that the confined atmosphere engendered was prejudicial to my curls. In vain I tried to ventilate the cap. Every gash made seemed to heal whole in no time. Then such a continual chafing as it kept up in a hot sun. Seeing my dislike to the thing, Kulu, my worthy friend, prevailed upon me to bestow it upon him. I did so, hinting that a good boiling might restore the original brilliancy of the colors. It was then that I mounted the turban. Taking a new regatta frock of the doctor's, which was of a gay calico, and winding it round my head in folds, I allowed the sleeves to droop behind, thus forming a good defense against the sun, though in a shower it was best off. The pendant sleeves adding much to the effect, the doctor called me the Bashaw with two tails. Thus arrayed, we were ready for Tamai, in whose green saloons we counted upon creating no small sensation. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.